Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, it's certainly been a busy week this week. Later on this show, we'll be talking about the budget and its implications for George Osborne's future and Brexit. But first of all, we're going to look at events across the pond. Last night was probably, by my reckoning, the third Super Tuesday of this election cycle, with a series of winner-takes-all states in the United States primary race. We do look like we're heading towards a Trump versus Clinton race in November. But is that the case? And I'm going to be discussing this in more detail with my distinguished panel, Mike Smithson of PoliticalBetting.com, Asa Bennett of The Telegraph, and Rob Vance of Penshone Berland. Welcome, chaps.
Good to be here, Kieran.
Good to be here.
Well, before I bring you guys in, let's look at what happened last night in the results in the States. Certainly looks like it's heading towards a Trump versus Clinton race. Missouri, too close to call on both counts. Sanders winning basically nowhere on the Democratic side, so a very good night for Hillary Clinton, it looks like. And on the Republican side, Donald Trump, big win in Florida, which of course is Rubio's home state. But John Kasich, as expected, win in Ohio and lots of delegates there. But at the same time, it does look like Donald Trump is in a very good place when it comes to securing the nomination. Rob, we haven't had a chance to have a chat about the the US race in the past couple of months. I mean, it certainly looks like Trump versus Clinton in November, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's almost certain now. I think the last remaining bastion was last night with the winner-takes-all states and sort of an ability to block Trump from the nomination would have been if Rubio had been able to carry Florida and, like John Kasich, was able to carry Ohio because they're both winner-takes-all. But Trump absolutely smashed him. I mean, I think outperformed even the polling that was going up onto the day. Rubio only was able to carry one county, admittedly a big county, Miami-Dade. But, you know, Trump, I think, I can't see anything that really stopping Trump now. Yeah, scraping the numbers together is reasonably difficult, but he will just grind it out. And I don't see there being enough states where Cruz is strong for him to be able to, you know, catch him and certainly or even block him from getting the majority he needs.
Now, it's a complicated contest, isn't it? Because it's all about delegates rather than, you know, who's winning, how many states have you won, what's the popular vote, although, of course, those things are related. I mean, if we look at the delegate count, let's stick with the Republican side firstly. You know, Ted Cruz isn't a million miles away from Donald Trump, but I guess you would say, you know, what are the states he's going to win to actually overturn Trump's lead?
Yeah, I mean, I think the kind of places where Trump is doing well, he's going to, you know, continue to have lots of those states coming up, whereas the kind of places that Cruz does well, they're not that big and there's not that many of them left. So I think really that's why I would say that Trump's going to get to the delegate count. But it could go, you know, we could be on the 45th, 46th, 47th state before he actually gets over the line. But I just don't see any way in which Cruz can get sufficient delegates to stop him
there. We'll come back to Donald Trump in a moment. I want to bring Mike in on some of the geography. But before we do, the Democrat race, it seems like you know, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, the fight goes on, but Hillary Clinton looks very strong. I mean, what's your perception of her night last night?
Yeah, I don't think there was much hope. I don't think there was much that Sanders could take out of last night that was particularly cheering for him. Even in counties and kinds of places where Sanders has, you know, done reasonably well up till now, he really wasn't performing that well. Clinton now, with, as you can see from the delegate count, nearly twice the number of delegates. Admittedly, a lot of those are super delegates, but I think, you know, even more than Trump, Sanders really, you know, needed a bit of a, what they say in American sports, a Hail Mary last night, and he didn't have one. So I think Clinton's going to get there, and that's really important because it means that Clinton can start pivoting her narrative towards what a general election matchup against, you know, Trump looks like. Whereas to a greater extent, Trump's going to continue having to fight, you know, Cruz and Kasich.
She tried to do a couple of weeks ago before Sanders came back in Michigan, but obviously now maybe more success. I mean, Mike, you've been looking at some of the sort of geographical spread on the Republican side, and I quite like this map that shows it's not so much delegates, but it's just who's won which counties, you know, on the Republican side. And you can see Donald Trump there and Ted Cruz having a very sort of clear geographical spread and where they're winning. I mean, what does this say to you in terms of where the, you know, why Trump's been so successful, but also where the race goes from here?
Well, the race goes from here. There aren't that many Midwest states where Ted Cruz is going to do well left for the, on the program, and that's his problem. It's actually quite interesting because it looks very similar to what you see in a general election where the sort of both coasts are going to be tend to be Democrat. And the sort of middle is very
different. Calling Donald Trump a Democrat?
No, but I'm just saying, just the pattern. And all the sort of the Deep South, all of those absolutely rock solid for Trump with very, very big majorities. In fact, it's interesting, it's where Hillary does well, Trump also does well.
I mean, you see this sort of green block in Ohio, of course, because John Kasich, obviously the governor of that state, wins and takes the delegates there. I mean, Asa, I'll bring you in on this. I mean, there's a lot of discussion around stopping Donald Trump, isn't there? And your Never Trump hashtags and things like this. But, you know, John Kasich had a good night last night. How do you assess his chances, but more generally, the chances of stopping Donald Trump?
Well, I'm very sceptical of Kasich's chances. Of course he was going to win Ohio. I mean, that's natural. It's the way of things. But then I've just been more stunned by the incompetence of Trump's opponents, because they've been all over the place as to how to deal with him. On the one hand, they initially tried to dismiss him as a joke. Then they tried to be all polite to him because they don't want to annoy the supporters. And then finally, like Marco Rubio, let's say, he discovers he has a spine and tries to actually attack Trump in the final debate and, you know, take him on over his record. And that's obviously far too little, far too late, as we've seen now with Rubio having to, you know, bow out of the race and be defeated by Trump in Florida. And as a result, the fact that when this strategy of Trump extends to things like technocratic, the broker conventions, which, you know, if that happened and if it didn't go Trump's way, as he says, you know, there'd be almost riots among certain members. People would be far too angry. It just wouldn't go against the right narrative of things. You're meant to, the Republican Party would be going Trump's way right now. They have to go for a sort of strong leader. And that's why, you know, it's going in Trump's way. Yet the fact that Never Trump Movement, as it's called on Twitter, you know, you can't have an anti-Trump critique just be a hashtag. It has to be something more, and it's not there.
I mean, Rob, isn't the problem with the Never Trump sort of argument not so much that there isn't a sort of groundswell of Republican opinion against him, but there just isn't a candidate that those people can rally around?
Never Trump, then who? But I think that what that tells us a lot is about how much Ted Cruz is loathed, because for a long time it's looked like Cruz is going to be the person left in a sense battling with Trump to the death. And actually what you see is a hell of a lot of the establishment in the Republican Party can't stomach Cruz either, and they're like, well, you know, a plague of both your houses, they can't get themselves organised. If they'd really wanted to stop Trump, they'd have probably needed to take the signal from Iowa and gone, he can organise rural, you know, evangelicals. You can see from the states, you know, that he's, you know, very strong in those kind of places with, you know, big, big rural states. What we need is some of the, you know, the cash and some of the support from, you know, the sort of urban, I wouldn't say perhaps moderate businessmen, you know, that kind of bit of the Republican coalition. We need to persuade them to get behind Cruz as the only way of stopping Trump. They didn't want to do that. They couldn't see that. They didn't do it. And they're going to be left with Trump. That's just how it is.
I want to talk about Marco Rubio in a moment. But if we look ahead to the calendar and where the races are coming up, I've looked at March and April. Obviously, the race goes beyond that. We have California, which is a particularly delegate-rich state, being the biggest. But if you look at the states that are coming up, I mean, which are the ones that sort of catch your eye? I mean, I was looking ahead to sort of Arizona and Utah, but then, you know, lo and behold, I think Arizona is the only state with lots of polling and Trump's ahead there. So, I mean, are there any particular states that you're looking out for?
So I think Arizona, close primary, it's, you know, in a region of the country relatively close to Texas. I think both Arizona and Utah could be reasonably good for Cruz. I haven't actually seen any polling recently, and a caucus in Utah is going to be notoriously difficult to predict anyway. But, you know, I think the map that we saw earlier would suggest that they are better territory for Cruz, certainly than Wisconsin, New York, and then, you know, New England, where I think we would expect to see Trump. Maybe Kasich pick up a couple, but really, that's going to be Trump territory. The one thing that could get in the way of that is an open primary in Wisconsin, which is winner takes all. I mean, if people really wanted to, an open primary means that you don't have to be pre-registered as a Republican in order to vote in it. You can turn up on the day and choose. And I suppose it's just about possible that people could get organised and go in there as moderates, Democrats, and choose to vote that way. There's some indication that there was some of that going on in states where, you know, Hillary didn't do as well as might have been expected, because moderates thought they didn't need to vote for Hillary, so they went and voted in the Republican primary instead. But other than that, you've got, you know, Trump's going to be looking at New York, where I can't, you know, I would, all expectations would be that he'd do very, very well. It's his home state.
He's going to win it in the general, apparently, so he's going to have to win it in the...
I would not put money on, whereas I think carrying it in a closed Republican primary, I think he's got every chance.
I mean, Mike, are there any states, if you're looking ahead to the immediate future, that you think, OK, that's where a John Kasich might sort of come through and capitalise on what's happened in Ohio? I mean, Pennsylvania would be the obvious one.
Obviously, Pennsylvania is it's a critical state in the general election. It's very much a Rust Belt state. It's a sort of state where you would think that Trump should appeal to the white working class. And I would expect him to do well. But on the other hand, Pennsylvania is a state which is incredibly well organised politically. All the party machines are extremely effective. And I would think that that could be a very interesting battle. Remember, Hillary had a big fight in Pennsylvania in 2008. And that was quite a struggle. And there is a sort of parallel.
I mean, Asa, I'll bring you in. I mean, if we're looking ahead to the general election, it looks like it's going to be Trump versus Clinton. I mean, yes, Marco Rubio is pulling out, has pulled out, but at the same time, it's not clear what impact that may or may not have at this stage. Do you share the view that many in the commentariat have, which is that Hillary Clinton is a shoo-in versus Trump in November?
Well, I just struggle to see how he can improve against Hillary Clinton, because on the one hand, he's definitely shown that he's got the ability to take the fight to her, and that, you know, that here is the line, and he runs over it by sort of bringing in Bill Clinton, bringing in the, you know, Monica Lewinsky scandal and all the rest, whenever she tries to sort of think he's anti-women and so forth. So he can really, you know, do the sort of dirty political cage match fighting in a sense. But in a general election, I would take a kind of the approach people say about Jeremy Corbyn with the general election, that, you know, you've had your bit of fun, you've made him the candidate, and then when you say, hang on, we're going to let this man have the keys to the White House, there's going to be a lot of last-minute anti-Trump voters who will say, stick with the devil, we know. Hillary Clinton, she's been scrutinised for years. We know every skeleton she has in the cupboard, practically. And they'll go for the safer option.
I mean, Rob, we were talking off-air before we started the recording about, you know, OK, which of the Obama states are the ones that a Donald Trump candidate flips to actually, you know, get to 270? If we're going to sort of humour ourselves and think that that's possible, maybe you do. I mean, what other states do you think Donald Trump would be looking at and fancying his chances to win? I suppose he would fancy his chances just about everywhere, but what would a sensible Trump supporter be looking at?
I mean, it's very, very hard, because the places where Trump tends to do well don't tend to necessarily be the kinds of places with high densities of, you know, swing states, essentially, right? They don't cross over that much. Florida last night, I mean, maybe Florida becomes a bit more competitive, but at the same time, there's a huge, you know, there's a huge Hispanic and Latino population in Florida who I don't think are about to vote for Trump, you know, given his comments about, you know, building a wall and getting Mexico to pay for it and so on. I just find it really hard for every sort of place where you think, oh, there's maybe a showing or he's done particularly well in a primary, there's then a kind of countervailing problem that he's created with a particular community. And to the point about, Hillary Clinton and his ability to attack her, oh, don't get me wrong, there is going to be fireworks from now until November. he will pull the kitchen sink and then some at Hillary. But I don't see anybody being that surprised by it. I find it hard to imagine that there's anything that the American electorate haven't heard about Hillary Clinton before and haven't already, in effect, priced into their decision. And I can't work out which kind of voter voted for Obama over Romney in 2012 who's now going to vote for Trump over Hillary in sufficient numbers to deny her the presidency.
I mean, Mike, to close with you in this segment, I mean, yeah, do you agree with Rob? Is this basically a game of 6 or 7 months and then Clinton wins?
I think I would. I've got money on this, and I've got money on Clinton. But I'm not totally confident, because the white working class males who Trump has managed to energise, those who feel particularly aggrieved about all sorts of things, he could do that in a general election. And I think that Hillary could be quite vulnerable. It depends how she plays it. I think if she's well advised and she plays it very calmly, a role model will be the way Carly Fioroni, who, remember, the only female candidate in the Republican race, she was doing very well against Trump. She was actually exposing him, and he never really got her.
She endorsed Ted Cruz, I believe.
And I think that Hillary could learn from that. I mean, one of the things that people I know on the Hillary campaign, I'm in contact with, they're saying, is that Trump has a fantastic mobilisation effect. They're expecting that all their issues about turnout are going to be solved by the fact that they're trying to stop Trump.
I mean, just something that's come to my mind, Rob. I mean, one of the factors that I think people aren't necessarily taking into account at this stage is the current president, Barack Obama. I mean, what, other than obviously endorsing Hillary Clinton, what impact do you think his legacy is going to have on the race? I mean, traditionally, when there's been two terms of one president, the popularity or otherwise of the incumbent, as it were, in the White House now, is going to be central to that campaign and the way it goes?
Well, it's an interesting question because in 2000, Bill Clinton was the most popular president pretty much on retirement, certainly in sort of living memory, and certainly on the Democratic side. But Al Gore essentially didn't utilise him very much in the campaign, and lots of people diagnosed Gore's defeat as being him attempting to differentiate himself too much and be his own man and not utilise the Clinton effect, if you like. Whereas, ironically enough, Obama, I think, will probably end up being a relatively less popular president at the end of his presidency, but actually very, very critical to, I think, to Mike's point, energising the base and ensuring that turnout is up. There is nothing more galvanising than, you know, the effect of, you know, someone like Trump being on the other side of the ticket. I mean, in 2008, people were very, very enthusiastic for Obama, but they didn't hate McCain in the same kind of way. They made jokes about him being old, and obviously people loved Obama, but it was a love for Obama that was driving to the polls. The kind of fear and hatred of the other guy in this kind of race, I think, will be very, very important, and that's going to be exploited a lot. And Obama's critical to that. You know, the Supreme Court announcement today is absolutely fundamental to that strategy, as are the down-ticket races in the House and the Senate, where, with Trump at the top of the ticket, the Democrats have got to be really, really hoping that they can make some kind of inroad into that majority in the House and maybe pick up some Senate seats that they weren't expecting to otherwise. Yeah. And I think Obama for those races is going to be crucial as well.
Certainly a lot to keep an eye out for in the coming months. Well, that's all we've got time for part one of the Political Betting Polling Matters show this week. Join us in a moment. We'll be talking about events closer to home. Today was, of course, the budget, and we'll be looking at the implications of that for George Osborne's future and the potential for Brexit. Welcome back to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show. My name's Kieran Pedley. Well, now we're going to be talking about events closer to home. Today was, of course, the budget, but, you know, as ever, the budget comes with wider implications. In a few short months, we'll have the EU referendum, and in a couple of years, or maybe sooner, we're going to have a new Prime Minister as David Cameron stands down. So certainly lots of potential implications off the back of what happened today. Acer, I'll come to you first. What were your implications of the budget today? Usually people are poring over the sort of individual measures that were announced, but it felt a little bit sparse to me. I mean, what was your...
Yes, I'll confess I was a bit underwhelmed, because on the one hand, there were some measures that clearly were meant to get the headlines and to have people chewing over, like the sugar tax, win a victory for Jamie Oliver's campaign, and that's going to get...
Gulping down.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to leave a bitter taste in some people's mouths. You know, the punneries and punsmiths will have great fun with this, and myself included. And besides this point, I mean, you then look deeper at the budget and the themes in it, really. It struck me as a very defensive budget that was sort of shoring up the cracks in his reputation with Tory MPs. The sugar tax is another thing entirely, I appreciate, given many backbenchers to think it's a liberal nanny statism. Yet, as well as this, there's been a sort of momentum over the last few months, sort of with the tide shifting away from George Osborne, as people thought of Boris Johnson, the kind of insurgent forces, the Eurosceptics, as these very exciting people who could one day hold the Tory torch. So as a result, he was having to try and say, look, I'm still in a position of power here. I can grant more tax cuts. I can advance a true Tory agenda. Whereas all Boris can do is kind of rattle his sabre from the outside and just say, you know, lovely words and mellifluous noises and all that sort of thing. And so as a result, it was, you know, keeping this influence and competence alive, because along with this, he had to answer the EU referendum question, because he risks being sidelined on this, because around half the party, half the MPs, back Brexit, whereas he obviously is a very ostentatious, loud and proud Remainer. So he had to put that case of the defence. So a lot of it, there's a theme of security. Every time he was saying the economy is still in a parlous and dangerous state, that's a way of saying, look, voters, it's not safe. You can't just choose Brexit for no cost at all. We have to, you know, work hard and work through this. This is why he tried to bring the OBR in, very proudly saying, nope, they're neutral. And actually, selectively quoting this word that had the word uncertainty in it, which is a magic word, leap in the dark. It suited his mantra well. And so, yes, in other words, there were the two key themes at play, his own career and the EU.
I mean, it strikes me that actually this kind of long-term economic plan or sort of perception that you any sort of change...
Hashtag long-term.
Yeah. any sort of deviation from that is a risk and you shouldn't do it.
Mm.
Has worked very well for the Conservatives in the past sort of five and a bit years, and obviously led to a general election victory in a large part back in May. But at some point, that's got to run. That sort of long-term economic plan argument's got to run out, hasn't it?
Well, it's interesting because obviously there was a poll I remember from Ipsos Mori which talked about how Voters think the economies may have got worse over the last year. They may think that they are worse off. However, when they were asked, OK, what do you think, George Osborne or John McDonnell, who would be the better Chancellor? They still stick with George Osborne because, you know, he's had years of experience there. And so he just merely has to seem one nation, the man people can understand. And, you know, yet he's got the centrist message now. That's why John McDonnell, you know, who obviously last year blew his response with this waving Chairman Mao's little red book around, you know, George Osborne just has to seem sane and he wins.
I mean, Rob, I'll bring you in on some of the polling because I guess there's two conflicting sort of polling things going on here. On the one hand, George Osborne's satisfaction rating seemed to be on the slide a little bit as economic confidence declines. On the other hand, as we can see here on this chart, and I won't point out that, as Asa did before we went live, that George Osborne is actually spelt wrong. And that would be a very unprofessional thing of me to do.
Mean to
naughty.
And mean, you know.
To a competitor.
There, but, for the grace, but for the grace of God, go I on that one, Kieran.
Yes,
we've all been there.
Mm. In their defence, that did trend on Twitter this afternoon. George Osborne, as if he was part of Black Sabbath.
The Osborne identity. Something to use there in the future, Asa. But, you know, on the flip side to his declining satisfaction ratings, he is preferred as a Chancellor to John McDonnell. I suppose Labour would say, well, hang on, he is the Chancellor, so there's a sort of incumbent bias there. But which of those do you think are the most significant trends? The fact that George Osborne's satisfaction ratings are declining, or the fact that overall he's just seen as a better Chancellor than John McDonnell?
Well, I think the interesting lens, both from a betting point of view and from a political analysis point of view, really is what it means for his, I think as Asa was alluding, his position within the Tory party. I think arguably the relative weakness in polling, as this bears out, of, you know, Labour on the economy, or specifically John McDonnell, depending on how you want to look at it. Of course, it's Corbyn as the leader of the opposition that gives the response to the budget under a specific quirk of our system. But, you know, I think he had actually a lot of room for manoeuvre in terms of the space. And you could see him actually being quite, you know, galloping across the centre ground on a lot of these kind of things. I mean, I think the soft drinks tax is a really good example of that. But also things about, you know, savings and pensions and, you know, cutting, you know, small business things. There's lots of stuff which certainly moderates within the Labour Party would have probably privately been quite applauding of today's budget. And actually, arguably, he was the benefit of a long-term economic plan is that you can continually, no matter what he says, continually kick difficult decisions down the long, you know, into the long grass. Because, you know, he I think in September, October time was sort of saying, oh, well, actually, everything's better and you can have some great stuff today. And today he basically said everything is worse. We'll do some more difficult things in the future. So, you know, I think, you know, it's a relatively easy budget for him today. The difficult bit is about the fights that he's picking with his own party and what that means for the EU referendum.
What I thought was very interesting with his savings measures aimed at young middle class people. And if you look at the polling, who are the people most likely to support remaining in the EU? It's that young middle-class group. And you feel that that was a big sort of, a little bit of a bait there. And he's been, because of course Osborne's been so criticised for feathering the nests of the elderly, people like me.
Rightly,
Over the years, with all sorts of amazing savings plans and all sorts of things to make their life easier and never taking away their perks like their bus passes, and to actually focus on the young, I think that was quite smart.
But should just be clear that for by young, under 40.
Yes, under 40. I was bemused by that, to put it bluntly, because given that young people don't understand pensions, there are many polls saying they don't particularly engage with the issue, they don't understand the pension system, then they've got this very lovely, simple-sounding, oh, yeah, put £1 in, oh, just put £4, I'll give you £1.
Yeah, that was very simple. And yeah,
it's this classic wonkery, right? I mean, he wanted to do more ambitious things.
Mm.
For various political reasons, not least the EU referendum, he chickened out of doing those things. So he's sort of flown this kite, which is going to apply. I mean, the uptake will be pitifully low, I expect, for all of the reasons that we've just previously discussed. Mm. You know, people trying to desperately scrape together a mortgage are going to be a little bit distrusting of it. It's new, all the rest of it. I think that, you know, it's in and of itself, it's not going to do a huge amount or revolutionise the pension industry. But he'll then use that as a wedge to next time round be like, actually, this is your new SIP. You know, this is the thing that's actually going to be the pension of the future. And we're going to quietly get rid of this thing, which is the tax-free lump sum and so on.
Let's talk about Brexit, because, I mean, it feels like all roads lead to, maybe not Brexit, but at least the EU referendum, when when we're talking about the budget today. There was an OBR poll.
ORB.
ORB. OBR don't do polls yet, they do forecasts.
Yeah, not very good ones by the looks of things. But there was a poll.
Sorry, just on record there, criticising the Office for Budget Responsibility. So.
There was a poll that was conducted by Telefone which showed the Leave ahead, which is goes very much against what the polls have been showing in the recent past. The Telefone polls showing roughly 60-40 Remain lead. The online polls showing sort of 50-50 split between Remain and Leave. One of the things I found more interesting was perhaps less so the actual headline figure, because frankly, who knows what the real number is, but some of the sort of cross breaks, which Mike alluded to a moment ago, which showed that sort of, for want of a better phrase, the sort of lower socioeconomic groups very much sort of more in favour of Brexit than others, and particularly outside of London. I mean, Rob, I suppose there's two ways of interpreting this. On the one hand, that's obviously quite bad for those people that want to remain in the EU, that there's this kind of committed group against. But on the other hand, these people are probably less likely to turn up, at least in traditional general elections.
Yeah, I mean, I think the turnout for this is really the key. And we've seen this in poll after poll after poll. And like you, I'm going to ignore the headline result and just really focus on the fact that we know that those that want to leave are much, much more motivated to go out and vote. You know, that so, you know, a low turnout election will benefit those that want to leave. A high turnout election, all other things being equal, will benefit those, and that's completely consistent in this poll. As you point out, I mean, the C2D numbers were very significantly against, and in fact, when you applied the when the data was unweighted, it looked to me as if actually Remain had a lead, and then when you weighted up the small number of C2DEs, that actually just about narrowly gave you know, those who want to leave the lead. So I think in and of itself that's interesting. But it's also interesting from the polling perspective, which is on the phone, them clearly having a great difficulty getting hold of economically or otherwise, getting hold in terms of, you know, how much it was costing to do the poll, getting hold of C2DE voters.
Well, that's always the same with phone polling.
I mean, but even more, I mean, they were much more significant.
Well, the first telephone poll political telephone poll that I'm aware of them doing, and there are certain aspects of it which I think that was, you know, they need to work on. The question itself, the standard question that's been used in all the polls until now, has been the one that's on the ballot. You know, should and which is 16 words. There's a massive preamble on the ORB poll, and they had a 42 word question. And it starts off with the word regardless, which I found very strange. The other thing I found a bit strange about the poll was that asking people what they did at the last general election, it found that 89% of those polled voted. Well, actually, we know that the actual turnout figure was 66.1%. So that doesn't suggest...
That, again, is pretty typical in terms of people claiming that they voted.
But you're
85% higher, I think.
But you find that, well, people like ICM, Ipsos Mori, Comres phone polls will be probably in the 72-73%. Mm. But 89% sounded quite high. So I'd like to see a few more polls from the firm before you start coming to a view on it.
We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I want to cover very briefly what happens next after the EU referendum, maybe a little bit about Labour review, Rob. But Asa, looking at the ahead to the referendum results, obviously the result's going to be important, but we were talking off air about the margin of victory or defeat being very important too when we look at the Conservative Party's future. I mean, what's your sense of the type of result that needs to happen for George Osborne to sort of reassert himself in this kind of Frank Underwood-like control of the Conservative Party? Not that I'm accusing him of killing anybody.
Of course not. But then, as well, I would say, put it one way, that Remain have to get 60% or up of the vote for it to be clear and decisive. Because as we saw in Scotland with this sort of 55-45 split, that gave rise to this kind of cybernat tribe on the Twitter, the hashtag 45. And, you know, the problem is now that the tempers are fraying so much and the attitude is so passionate on the Eurosceptic side that, you know, if you've seen grassroots out, the fact that they can get 2,000 people to come to a hall in Kettering, you know, these people are you know, very much fanatical, as Lord Ashcroft's research once said, about you know, leaving the EU.
But if they're fundamentally in the minority, they can be as fanatical as they like, can't they?
No, but they're going to keep pushing then, in that case. I mean, you've seen how the Eurosceptics and have questioned and held up the referendum quite rightly, one may argue, to scrutiny on things like PERDA and all the sort of technical rules. You know, they can do this again if necessary, if it's not, as they would put it, fair and, you know, fairly, you know, held. Because obviously they would find, you know, judges' inquiries practically. And this is why there's loads of there's a legal challenge already from expats, for example, in the High Court, to try so they can get a vote. Because when you've come down to it, you know, given something as big as this, there'll be a lot of people who'll think they've been, you know, badly done by in this.
I mean, Rob, I'll bring you in on Labour. We haven't talked about Labour too much today. Obviously, as you alluded to earlier, today was the day where Jeremy Corbyn responds to the budget rather than John McDonnell, which is, as you say, a quirk in our system. But look at the EU referendum. What do you think the pitfalls are, or what do you think the challenges are for Labour? There are some murmurings. I think I saw an article in the Sunday Times, or it was the Times or the Sunday Times, about a potential Labour, a coup by Labour MPs taking on Jeremy Corbyn's leadership after the EU referendum. I mean, do you think Labour might become the story again in the coming months?
I think after the referendum, perhaps. But I think there's a fairly narrow window between then and the summer, and, you know, you're suddenly into silly season and nothing happens, and then you're at a party conference. And so I think the reality is that nothing really is going to happen this year. I'd be surprised if anything happened this year. And from the referendum point of view, Labour's policy will be on a public sort of thing to basically not say anything at all. Like, Corbyn isn't that enthusiastic either way. Doesn't have anything really to bring to the table in terms of persuading swings one way or other on the referendum question. The Labour Party itself, I'm sure at a grassroots level, will provide its really quite useful muscles in terms of trying to get out the vote and to, you know, campaign and so on. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the airwaves and the media campaign and so on, actually, you know, seeing effectively, you know, the current Prime Minister against, you know, the most likely contender, I think, now for the being the next Prime Minister, give or take, fighting it out every day over the EU is like, wow, why would we want to intrude on private grief?
A lot depends, I think, on what happens on May the 5th in the Scottish elections, the Welsh elections, and, of course, in the London elections and the locals. If Labour not making gains in seats, which they need to do, every opposition party since 1982, the Falklands, has in non-general election years, increase their number of councillors in the local elections. And if at the same time Labour manages to finish up third in Scotland, as some of the latest polling is showing, then that is quite serious.
A new jockalypse, almost. There's a new jockalypse for Labour.
Oh, yes, you know. Yes, that's a jockalypse.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, quite a lot this is priced in. It's not going to be the shock, right? I mean, I think people... Wales were likely to lose, you know, the Labour Party's likely to lose some seats. Scotland, I still don't think they will quite come third, but, you know, it's possible. And I think most likely Sadiq Khan will win London, and that will kind of be embraced as the, you know, as the win, and that will be enough in effect to keep Corbyn there for at least until the end of the year or whatever.
Lots of races for us to sort of delve into in the coming weeks. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. That's all we've got time for the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show this week. Certainly a lot to digest. It does look as though we're heading for a Trump versus Clinton race in the future. But what happens in the EU referendum is almost anybody's guess at this stage. But in between then and now, as Mike alludes to, we're going to have a series of election contests in May. And we'll be talking about those more in the coming weeks. So stay tuned.